This is Audible.
Broadside Books and Harper Audio present The Russia Hoax, The Illicit Scheme to Clear Hillary Clinton and Frame Donald Trump, by Greg Jarrett. Read by Charles Constant.
To Kate, Grace, and Liv, for your love and support. The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal. Justice Louis Brandeis. Preface. An insidious abuse of power. I write this the week that James Comey began peddling his vainglorious book. It reads like a Harlequin romance, except that the protagonist is in love with himself. Comey sermonizes about lies and lying people. This is perversely ironic coming from a man who, more than anyone else, is responsible for the most notorious hoax in modern American history. As director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Comey launched a dilating investigation into Donald J. Trump in the summer of 2016. There was not a whiff of credible evidence to legally justify the probe, so in a deception worthy of a solid street hustle, Comey labeled it a counterintelligence matter. The clever feint allowed for a covert criminal investigation in search of a crime, reversing and bastardizing the legal process. This is what abuse of power looks like. For the better part of 2 years, the FBI, U.S. intelligence apparatus, mainstream media, Democrats, and eventually Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team of partisans peered furiously into every obscure corner and crevice for some proof that Trump colluded with Russia to steal the 2016 presidential election. They seemed to believe that Trump could not possibly have won absent some treasonous conspiracy hatched by him in the bowels of the Kremlin. They were convinced he was an illegitimate president. Besides, Comey and his minions didn't like Trump. Man or his politics. They loathed him. The vaunted director, who surely knew better than naive and gullible voters, would be the savior of the nation. Armed with immense power, Comey and other top officials at the FBI became the law unto themselves. The end would justify the means, if only collaboration with the Russians could be found. Failing that, the investigation itself could be manipulated to create the illusion of wrongdoing. The ensuing scandal would be sufficient to annul Trump. It wasn't merely that the flamboyant businessman-turned-candidate would upset the natural order of the political landscape, but as president, he would likely show the director the door at the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C. There is nothing that will motivate a man like Comey more than the prospect of power forfeited. Something had to be done. But first, Comey and his confederates had to turn an even tougher trick by exculpating Hillary Clinton, the Democratic presidential nominee, from the sundry crimes she appeared to have committed by storing copious classified documents on her unauthorized private computer system at the Clinton homestead. Despite a subpoena to preserve her records, tens of thousands of government documents were deleted, her server wiped clean, and numerous devices destroyed. How exactly could the FBI circumvent the inevitable multi-count indictments against Clinton for everything from obstruction of justice to mishandling of classified documents? It would not be easy. Criminal codes would have to be creatively reinterpreted or deliberately misconstrued. A grand jury must be avoided or diminished at all costs. But the Department of Justice would acquiesce, since it was brimming with Clinton allies, especially Attorney General Loretta Lynch. Best of all, President Barack Obama had sent out the clarion call on national television that his chosen Democratic successor should not be prosecuted, since she never intended to jeopardize national security, notwithstanding what he characterized as her carelessness. Comey was instrumental to this scheme. He penned an exoneration statement well before the FBI interviewed 17 key witnesses, including Clinton herself. Then he commandeered the authority of the Attorney General in delivering his infamous pronouncement that no charges should be brought. No mention was ever made of another vexing FBI probe into whether Clinton had engaged in corrupt acts with the Russians by hanging the equivalent of a for sale sign on her office door as Secretary of State. That investigation quietly vanished under the auspices of the Obama administration. Thus, there was never a serious examination of Clinton and the various laws she seemed to have plainly violated. The entire exercise was a preconceived charade with a predetermined outcome. All of this set the stage for Comey and the FBI to pursue its imaginary case of collusion against Trump. The evidence was scant until a scurrilous anti-Trump dossier surfaced. It was secretly funded by the Clinton campaign and delivered to the FBI by a former British spy who claimed to have spoken to unidentified Russians. The FBI first met with the author of the dossier on the same day that Comey absolved Clinton. But try as it may, the Bureau seemed unable to verify its inflammatory contents, alleging that Trump had been collaborating with Russia for at least 5 years. No matter, the FBI appropriated the document as a pretext for spying on a Trump campaign associate, while simultaneously advancing their investigation of the candidate who would unexpectedly become president. They actively hid the fact that Clinton and Democrats had underwritten the specious document. At the same time, Comey's FBI deployed an undercover government informant to infiltrate the Trump campaign to induce or entrap associates into saying something incriminating. The unverified dossier was leaked to the press, and by the time Trump was sworn in as president, the mainstream media had its collusion tale. It was off to the races, as journalists propagated their nonstop narrative that Trump was undoubtedly guilty of collaborating with Moscow to win the election. But a curious thing happened on the way to their twin goal of indictment and impeachment. Collusion is not a crime, except in antitrust law. Reporters and anchors never bothered to cite a specific statute because none could be found in the criminal codes. Not that they ever bothered to look. They were satisfied, indeed anxious, to level the accusation as a legal conclusion because their bias against Trump was so impassioned and pervasive that it became impervious to the facts. The media's miscalculation was compounded by the inconvenient absence of any incriminating evidence to prove this invisible offense called collusion. They were adamant that meeting with or talking to a Russian, even on American soil, was somehow an undefined crime, unprotected by the First Amendment. Any chance encounter or casual handshake with a Russian was vilified. Breathless media accounts inflated trivial contacts beyond reason. They fanned tiny embers, repeatedly arguing that this much smoke means there will eventually be fire. When the truth finally sunk in that collusion appeared to be a myth, the press seamlessly shifted to a different accusation, that Trump must have obstructed justice by attempting to impede the FBI's investigation. In this, Comey once again became the central character. When he was fired as FBI director for repeated violations of the Bureau's regulations, he admitted pilfering government memorandums, which he improbably claimed as his own, for the sole purpose of triggering a special counsel who just happened to be his longtime friend and ally, Robert Mueller. When Comey testified before Congress, he all but accused the president of attempting to obstruct his investigation, even though the detailed memos offered no such allegation. it was a Machiavellian move to perpetuate the fabricated case against Trump. Over the course of a year, Mueller's investigation did manage to render several indictments. However, none of them had anything whatsoever to do with collusion with the Russians. Did Moscow meddle in the presidential election? Yes, in much the same way it had tried to tamper for decades. Their design was to sow discord in the Western democracy they so detest. But the notion that anyone in the Trump campaign had somehow been complicit was dispelled when the indictment of 13 Russians revealed that no Americans knowingly participated. To date, no actionable proof of collusion involving Trump has surfaced. They did, however, sow their desired political discord thanks to a deluded and compliant American left. As I write this, Comey is several days into his adoration tour, hawking his book and pocketing millions of dollars. As he does so, he accuses Trump of being morally unfit, ignoring that he was all too willing to serve the same president he now so freely condemns. There is something profoundly incongruous about a man who pontificates about professional ethics but seems bereft of them himself. His hypocrisy was underscored when 3 days after his book was published, it was confirmed that the Inspector General of the Justice Department was investigating Comey for leaking the presidential memos and mishandling classified information. FBI agents were forced to conduct searches to contain the leak. It is conceivable that Comey committed the very offenses he helped Clinton escape. Self-righteous people tend to self-immolate. The tale of the Russia hoax is a labyrinth of intertwined stories. Clinton's penchant for secrecy surrounding her dealings with foreign government and money sources almost certainly propelled her to set up her private server. When caught, she spun a series of deceptions to justify her actions. Comey and company abided by contorting the law to clear her path to the presidency and influence its outcome. This same small group of Washington insiders then abused the power of their positions to conjure a case against Trump to defeat him in the election. When that failed, they doubled down to frame the new president for crimes he did not commit. The dossier, which Comey confessed was salacious and unverified, was their in flagrante delicto, or smoking gun. Its lack of authenticity was irrelevant. It would be politicized and weaponized to achieve the objective of destroying Trump and driving him from office. The provenance of this book can be found in the many opinion columns I began composing 3 years ago, in which I argued that Clinton mishandled classified documents and violated the law. When Comey inexplicably absolved her and launched a fraudulent investigation of Trump, even more columns were written. But the shape and theme of the book did not fully materialize until October 2017, when I published The Trump-Russia Collusion and Other Great Hoaxes, followed by a column titled, Did the FBI and the Justice Department Plot to Clear Hillary Clinton, Bring Down Trump? By this time, it had become evident to me that the FBI, as well as the Department of Justice, had become cesspools of corruption that played a direct hand in attempting to influence the election and subvert the democratic process. The greatest peril to democracy today is not a foreign force, but the abuse of power from within. Those who operate under color of authority are prone to exploit it for political reasons and personal gain. In a government of laws, they too often fail to follow the law themselves. As Justice Brandeis put it, if the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. The most celebrated form of governance known to the world is democracy. It is a system of, by, and for the people. Because of this personal construct, democracy is susceptible to the same human frailties that afflict us all: greed, prejudice, hubris, intellectual dishonesty, and moral weakness. Government, therefore, is only as sound and effective as the people who are empowered to run it at any given time. This is its fundamental imperfection. Sometimes, driven by these flaws of the human condition, democracy can be trifled with by those who hold the reins of power in government. Despite carefully devised checks and balances, individual positions are nevertheless misused in ways unseen by the public. Systems are unduly influenced in defiance of both the law and conscience. Misdeeds are covered up. This is the story of the Russia hoax. It is a cautionary annal of the damage wrought when those who serve in government seek to undermine it. Comey and other participants in this hoax were not interviewed for the book. I doubted they would consent and distrusted their credibility. My conclusions about their motivations and intent are drawn from the extensive public record of their conduct in these matters and interviews with current and former employees of the FBI and Justice Department about such conduct. And, based on this record, no other conclusion is reasonably supportable. Greg Jarrett, April 21st, 2018.
Chapter 1. Hillary Clinton's Email Server. Convenience is not a legal principle. Lord Justice Edward Pierce, Queen's Bench, High Court of Justice of England and Wales, 1961. This is a story of corruption. It begins, as it must, with Hillary Clinton. Clinton's determination to set up a private email server in the basement of her home to use as the exclusive method for electronically communicating all of her official business as Secretary of State was a fateful decision. At its core, the idea was fundamentally reckless. It also appears to have been criminal. More than any other event or factor, it led to the inexorable end to her aspiration to be President of the United States. The email setup. Unraveling Clinton's private server apparatus was complicated by the hidden nature of its design. The domain was not registered in her name, but under a separate identity, even though the IP address was connected to the Chappaqua, New York residence of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Indeed, the server itself was installed in the basement of their house. The State Department never certified the server as secure, as its rules require. Thus, anyone within the home, including those without security clearance, had physical access to it, as did two individuals who were instrumental in its installation, operation, and maintenance, Justin Cooper and Brian Pagliano. Neither was cleared for handling classified information. Why would Clinton want to keep all her communications as Secretary of State on a private server? The obvious answer is often the correct one. With no emails on a government account, Clinton would be able to avoid complying with various requests filed by the media and the public under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. This explanation is reinforced by the conscious decision she and her staff made not to utilize an electronic program called SMART, which would have preserved her records for the government. The motivation behind Clinton's decision to use a secret server invites the question, if someone has nothing to hide, why hide? People who engage in improper, if not illegal, activities often cloak them in darkness. They seek to obscure their illicit behavior. Clinton may have wanted to hide decisions and mistakes that would look bad when she ran for president. She may have wanted to keep from public view any evidence that she and her husband used her position of power in government to enrich themselves. As will be detailed in Chapter 4, their charity, the Clinton Foundation, served as the conduit for hundreds of millions of dollars that flowed from foreign sources at the same time Hillary appeared to have exerted influence on their behalf. At the same time, Bill pocketed tens of millions for speaking engagements overseas, many of them connected to his wife's work. The improper use of Clinton's surreptitious server stands in stark contrast to the promises she made before taking office. While campaigning for president in 2008, Clinton had promised complete transparency and vowed to fulfill all FOIA requests. In retrospect, her public assurances were nothing more than a carefully crafted deception. Her private server afforded her a clever and clandestine way to evade the public disclosure of her communications and to hide her self-serving deals. On or about the day Clinton was sworn into office, January 21, 2009, the State Department activated a classified email account on its secure government server for her benefit. Clinton never used it. Instead, she chose to utilize her unsecured private server for all her work-related communications, including classified documents. How this went undetected during her 4-year term remains inexplicable, unless those with knowledge were complicit in enabling her scheme or turned a blind eye to Clinton's conduct. Staffers at the State Department and the White House, including President Obama, regularly communicated with the Secretary of State at her private email address. Documents uncovered by the FBI show that Obama used a pseudonym in communicating with Clinton on her private email account. Sometimes he did so while his Secretary of State was overseas using an unprotected mobile device. When the FBI showed a copy of one such Obama email to Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin, she exclaimed, "How is that not classified?" Indeed, it surely was classified. Thereafter, the White House refused to disclose the contents of any of the president's emails involving his fake name. Obama was not only concealing his communications with an alias, he was mishandling classified information in the same negligent manner as Clinton. This may explain why the FBI and the DOJ were motivated not to charge Clinton. If they did so, Obama's mishandling of classified communications would be exposed. It is hard to imagine that the president and others never noticed that Clinton was using a non-government, non-secure private account. Indeed, emails prove that many of them did know. But the Secretary of State was surrounded by longtime Clinton cronies. They shielded her. They were not about to challenge the person they were certain would become the next president of the United States. Clinton's disdain for regulations and statutory law was also evident in her use of BlackBerries linked to her home server, despite warnings from State Department security personnel. According to an FBI report, she insisted on keeping her mobile device in an area where they were not allowed because hackers can infiltrate them to record classified discussions. While on foreign visits, Clinton incessantly used her unprotected BlackBerry to send or receive dozens of confidential emails that were susceptible to interception by foreign governments. She ignored security protocols and the law with impunity. Clinton's server discovered. Before Clinton left office in early 2013, FOIA requests seeking information about her emails resulted in terse statements from the State Department that no such records could be located. No wonder. Clinton had stealthily kept all her emails on her private server and never preserved them on a government account as regulations required. These vacuous responses to FOIA demands should have immediately raised red flags of alarm. It was not until 2014 when the House Benghazi Committee began investigating the September 11, 2012 terrorist attack in Libya during Clinton's tenure that the true nature and extent of her secret server began to slowly unfold. During the summer of 2014, the committee demanded access to her emails, which prompted the State Department to contact Clinton, who was now out of office. Negotiations among lawyers ensued, and several months later, on December 5, 2014, Clinton reluctantly handed over 30,490 emails from her private account. Simultaneously, she withheld some 31,839 emails, insisting they were private and personal. At least one of Clinton's lawyers, Heather Samuelson, who helped sort the emails that included classified documents, appeared to have no security clearance in violation of the law. Although Clinton later stated under oath that she had provided all work-related emails, this was not true. According to then-FBI Director James B. Comey, thousands of work-related emails were improperly held back by Clinton. Upon examining the large cache of documents provided by Clinton's attorneys, the Benghazi Committee realized something was amiss. As Secretary of State, Clinton had never used her secure government account for any of her communications. Instead, she had conducted all of her business on an unsecured account on a private server located in the basement of her residence. It was, in essence, a hacker's paradise. Confidential information was exposed to theft. Foreign governments with their sophisticated computer expertise could readily access America's classified secrets. Clinton's egregious breach of rules, regulations, and laws jeopardized national security. New York Times broke the story wide open on March 2, 2015, creating a firestorm of controversy with immense political consequences for Clinton, just as she prepared to launch another bid for President of the United States in the next month. Her actions, decried by many as irresponsible and reckless, called into question both her judgment and competency to hold the highest public office in the land. More important, Clinton's unmitigated disregard for the law quickly metastasized into allegations of criminal wrongdoing. Clinton's attempts to cover up. Initially, Clinton employed a phalanx strategy of no comment. It did not quell the gathering storm. On March 10, 2015, she decided to address the matter with reporters by holding a news conference. It was an unqualified disaster. Under questioning, she appeared unsteady in front of cameras, unsure of her answers, and seeming to prevaricate at every turn. Her statements stretched credulity. Clinton insisted, "I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email. There is no classified material." That remark was brazenly untrue. Clinton had sent numerous classified emails on her unauthorized and unsecured server. Later, when faced with evidence that contradicted her claim, Clinton changed her story significantly by stating, "I am confident that I never sent or received any information that was classified at the time it was sent or received." In other words, she claimed the classifications were made retroactively. But this amended statement was also false. In truth, the FBI confirmed that 110 of her emails contained classified information at the time they were sent or received. As the emerging facts continued to belie Clinton's statements, she altered her story for a third time by claiming, "I never sent or received any email that was marked classified." Translation: the classified documents on her email server were unmarked, and as such, she could not be expected to know that they were classified. But this was another untrue statement. It earned her four Pinocchios, the worst rating from the Washington Post fact-checker Glenn Kessler. Many of Clinton's emails were indeed marked classified, as the FBI later revealed. While testifying before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Director Comey called Clinton's statement not true. Moreover, the markings were irrelevant under the law, since the content, not the marking, made them classified. It is important to note that knowledge of a document's classification status is of no legal consequence. Thus, it was no defense for Clinton to claim she did not know that matters were classified. As Secretary of State, she was privy to many of the nation's most guarded secrets. Did they have to be specially marked top secret or classified for her to recognize them for what they were? Over the course of 4 years, she was America's top diplomat, with direct access to the most sensitive information and data. Assuming a modicum of competency, classified information should have been recognized by her instantaneously. Still, Clinton seemed to be arguing her own incompetence. That is, she should not be held legally liable because she was too uninformed or inept to recognize classified materials without their markings. But ignorance and maladroitness are not defenses under the law. This rendered Clinton's explanations of her actions all the more unconvincing. One of the more outlandish, if not comical, explanations offered by Clinton during her FBI interview was that she did not realize that the parenthetical C meant classified material at the confidential level when it appeared on documents. She claimed that she thought it was simply a way of organizing messages in alphabetical order, although there were no other letters used in this way on the same records. Several former FBI officials interviewed for this book accused Clinton of deliberately deceiving the FBI during her interview. Bill Gavin, who first joined the Bureau in 1967 and became assistant director, did not believe her rationale for one moment. C stands for cunning. She knew exactly. You cannot have access to classified information without going through the briefings, fully understand what the briefings are telling you, and then signing off on documents admitting that you understood what the briefings have said. To say she didn't understand what C meant is just a bald-faced lie. She understood what was going on. She didn't care because she knew she was allowed to do anything she wanted to do. Oliver Buck Revelle, who spent 30 years with the FBI and rose to become the associate deputy director, called Clinton's alibi absurd. She didn't know what the C on top of the documents meant? No one believed her. She didn't even believe it herself. That's so nonsensical. It's just ridiculous. I think it reflected a total disregard of the system and the rules that have been established to protect the system. She exposed the nation's secrets through her emails. She took the privileged approach to virtually everything she's ever done in her life, disregarding the rules and regulations that apply to everyone else. All the excuses offered by Clinton were subsequently contradicted by both the FBI and the Inspector General at the State Department. Undaunted by her series of demonstrably false statements, she then resorted to a blanket assertion that her actions were legally permissible. In a July 7, 2015 interview, Clinton insisted, "Everything I did was permitted. There was no law. There was no regulation. There was nothing that did not give me the full authority to decide how I was going to communicate. Everything I did was permitted by law and regulation." This was another audaciously untrue assertion by Clinton that earned her 3 Pinocchios from the Washington Post fact checker. Her claim was also disproven by the State Department's own Inspector General, who took office after Clinton left her post but investigated her conduct while she was in office. First, the IG found that Clinton did not comply with the department's policies that were implemented in accordance with the Federal Records Act. Second, the IG determined that Clinton never sought approval for her server, and had she done so, it would have been rejected as a risk to national security. Third, the IG learned that employees who voiced concerns about the private server were instructed to never speak of the secretary's personal email system again. Fourth, the IG concluded that any classified material never should have been transmitted via an unclassified personal system. A federal judge also voiced his disbelief in Clinton's rationalizations and alibis. During a FOIA lawsuit by a nonprofit group called Judicial Watch to recover emails, U.S. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan scolded Clinton over her disdain for the law when he said, "We wouldn't be here today if this employee had followed government policy." Clinton knew she broke the law. Clinton certainly knew that she was breaking the law when she made the conscious decision to use a personal server for all her work that would, as Secretary of State, necessarily involve classified information, including top-secret records. On January 22, 2009, the day after she was sworn into office, she signed a document titled Classified Information Non-Disclosure Agreement, which stated the following: "I have been advised that the unauthorized disclosure, unauthorized retention, or negligent handling of classified information by me could cause damage or irreparable injury to the United States, or could be used to advantage by a foreign nation. I have been advised that any unauthorized disclosure of classified information by me may constitute a violation or violations of U.S. criminal laws." Importantly, the document instructed Clinton that classified material may not always be marked as classified on the face of the documents, but that it would still be considered classified information. Thus, she was bound by law to protect it in a secure place, not in her home. A second document entitled Sensitive Compartmented Information Non-Disclosure Agreement, executed by Clinton that same day, acknowledged that she had received a comprehensive security briefing that instructed her on all the applicable laws involving sensitive information and classified materials, and how those documents must be kept secure. Clinton could hardly claim amnesia as a defense, since she sent an order to every State Department employee 2 years later, on June 28, 2011, cautioning them not to do what she was doing covertly in violating the law. Clinton's order warned, "Avoid conducting official department business from your personal email accounts." There is little doubt that Hillary Clinton flagrantly and shamelessly ignored not only State Department regulations, but federal law, making it a crime to mishandle classified documents. She may have also had a direct hand in the destruction of evidence. On March 4, 2015, Congress sent a letter to Clinton instructing her to preserve all her emails. Subpoenas were sent immediately thereafter. The request included both work-related emails and any of those she had previously withheld as personal. 3 weeks later, on March 25th, more than 30,000 of Clinton's emails were deleted. It is unclear how many of those emails might have been relevant to the subpoenas, since they have vanished. Her server was wiped clean by using a file-deleting software program called BleachBit. The act of defying a congressional subpoena is impudent at best, criminal at worst. Destruction of records in any federal investigation constitutes obstruction of justice and a violation of the Federal Records Act. While the FBI did manage to recover several thousand deleted emails that were in fact work-related, no charges were ever brought against Clinton or anyone else involved in their deletion and destruction. Former Assistant Director of the FBI Steve Pomerantz is convinced Clinton knew she was breaking the law, but didn't care. It is consistent with everything I know about the Clintons. They make their own rules, and it's wrong. Hillary Clinton engaged in conduct that was dangerous to the national security of the United States, and of course lying about it only compounds the problem. The Clintons have a history of lying. That's what they do. First they commit the offense, then they lie about it. That's what they do. It is revealing that Clinton spent 5 months refusing to turn over her email server to either the Benghazi Committee or the FBI, despite repeated demands to do so. In the end, she relented when faced with the likelihood that Bureau agents would begin serving search warrants to seize it on their own. Fearing a knock on the door of her private residence, Clinton finally capitulated. Although Clinton is a trained lawyer who graduated from Yale Law School, she seemed oblivious to the law. Or more likely, she felt that the law did not apply to her. Yet there is no station in life or standing in government that absolves someone from criminal conduct. In this way, we are all creatures of the law and are bound to obey it. An orderly society cannot function if it permits individuals to disregard the law with impunity. This fundamental principle, enunciated by the U.S. Supreme Court more than a century ago, is what gives sustenance to our democracy. Without it, lawlessness, chaos, and tyranny at the hands of the few would surely ensue. It follows, then, that Clinton is no higher or lower than any American. She must abide by the rule of law regardless of her condition or circumstance. Former independent counsel Joseph DeGeneva is convinced Clinton did not care about complying with the law. Mrs. Clinton knew precisely what she was doing. She chose to ignore the law. There is simply no explanation other than that. The requirements of the law were too oppressive for her. She was different. She viewed herself differently. These restraints and constraints were something that were for other people, not for her, because she was a special, special person. I think what is true about Mrs. Clinton is that she had enablers around her all the time. No one was strong enough or willing to tell her she shouldn't do certain things because they all wanted to be part of the big game, which ended with her being President of the United States. The law. Whenever a government official creates or obtains a record during the course and scope of his or her employment, the Federal Records Act and the Foreign Affairs Manual require that it be captured and preserved by the agency. Clinton did not do so at any time during her service as Secretary of State, thereby violating the law on a daily basis for 4 years. Every single one of her work-related emails constituted federal records, not her personal property. It is no excuse under the law that others with whom Clinton communicated via email within the State Department may have kept their own records in the agency system or elsewhere. The records on Clinton's system were never concurrently archived at the Department of State. She communicated with many other people who were not employees of the agency or government, and these emails were never captured or archived. At no time was Clinton ever authorized to create her own private server for record keeping. Clinton should have been charged with stealing government documents. Converting government records for personal use is a felony under the law. It is, in a word, theft. Consider Title 18 of the U.S. Crimes and Criminal Procedure Code, or USC, Section 41. Whoever embezzles, steals, purloins, or knowingly converts to his use or the use of another, or without authority, sells, conveys, or disposes of any record, voucher, money, or thing of value of the United States or of any department or agency thereof, or whoever receives, conceals, or retains the same with intent to convert it to his use or gain, knowing it to have been embezzled, stolen, purloined, or converted, shall be fined under this title, or imprisoned not more than 10 years, or both. Isn't this precisely what Clinton did? She converted government documents for her use on a private server in her home. Only after she was out of office and under legal pressure from the Benghazi Committee did she give some of the documents to the State Department nearly 2 years later. That's like stealing a car, but only giving it back after being caught by authorities red-handed. The return of the car does not vitiate the crime. But Clinton also concealed, removed, and destroyed government documents and wiped her private record-keeping server clean by using a file-deleting software, even though she had been instructed by Congress to preserve all documents. The FBI later discovered that thousands of work-related documents had never been turned over by her to the federal government, thus depriving the government of its property. On this basis, Clinton violated Title 18 of the USC, Section 2071B. Whoever having the custody of any such record, proceeding, map, book, document, paper, or other thing, willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies, or destroys the same, shall be fined under this title, or imprisoned not more than 3 years, or both. Clinton created a private server for all her official communications as Secretary of State. In doing so, she purposefully deprived the government of the documents that belonged not to her, but to the government. Case law supports a criminal prosecution under these facts. But there's more. By her own admission, Clinton directed that all her emails be deleted. Although Clinton had promised to cooperate fully with the Benghazi Committee and its demand to preserve and produce documents, her lawyer, David Kendall, subsequently sent a letter to the House Benghazi Committee on March 27, 2015, confirming that both personal and business emails had been removed from his client's server and backup systems. Making a materially false statement to Congress is a crime under Title 18 of USC, Section 1001. It is also obstruction of justice under Title 18 of USC, Section 1505 and Section 1515B, to act corruptly by withholding, concealing, altering, or destroying a document or other information in a congressional investigation. Not all of Clinton's emails were produced as the committee had demanded and as Clinton had represented. The act of wiping her server clean of all original documentary evidence sought by congressional committee meets the legal requirements of these crimes. Significantly, Clinton broke other laws involving the very serious matter of mishandling of classified documents. In this statement to the national media on July 5, 2016, FBI Director Comey revealed his findings. From the group of 30,000 emails returned to the State Department, 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. 8 of those chains contained information that was top secret at the time they were sent. 36 chains contained secret information at the time, and 8 contained confidential information, which is the lowest level of classification. Separate from those, about 2,000 additional emails were up-classified to make them confidential. The information in those had not been classified at the time the emails were sent. Comey's statement should have been the equivalent of an indictment of Clinton under Title 18 of USC, Section 793F. Whoever being entrusted with or having lawful possession or control of any documents relating to national defense, one, through gross negligence permits the same to be removed from its proper place of custody, or two, having knowledge that the same has been illegally removed from its proper place of custody, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years, or both. Clinton surely knew that if her emails were stored on her private server in the basement of her home, there would inevitably be innumerable classified documents residing in an unauthorized place. This very clearly jeopardized national defense as the statute envisions. At the very least, her conduct was grossly negligent as the above statute requires. But beyond gross negligence, Clinton's handling of classified information appears to have been quite intentional. She intended to establish a non-government server and intended that it be used for all her government business, which necessarily included classified documents. Such willful and deliberate retention is defined as criminal under Title 18 of the USC, Section 793D and E. This will be explored in greater detail in the next chapter. A separate law also criminalizes Clinton's actions. Title 18 of the USC, Section 1924A, prohibits the following. Whoever, being an officer of the United States, and by virtue of his office, employment, position, or contact, becomes possessed of documents or materials containing classified information of the United States, knowingly removes such documents or material without authority, and with the intent to retain such documents or materials at an unauthorized location, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 1 year, or both. The facts show that Clinton intended to create a private server. She knew it was unauthorized, yet she deliberately used it for all her electronic communications, including classified documents. These actions are violations of the above-stated statutes. Other people in government have been prosecuted and convicted with much less incriminating evidence, as will be explained in the next chapter. In addition to the potential felony charges outlined, Clinton could also be charged with multiple conspiracy counts, since her actions involved acting in concert with other participants as defined in Title 18 of the USC Section 371 and Title 18 USC 286. Clinton's protectors. The evidence shows that Clinton felt privileged and above the law. She wanted to control the records of her high office and keep them secret at any cost. She thwarted public access to non-classified documents. In the process, she left vital classified information, including top-secret material, vulnerable to theft by hackers, foreign intelligence services, and governments seeking to steal America's national security information. Clinton's principal defense of her actions was, in truth, no defense at all. She insisted that she utilized a private server for convenience, as if that was somehow a legal excuse for violating multiple criminal statutes. The law abides no such defense, as Lord Justice Pierce observed long ago. She also attempted to shift the blame or minimize her responsibility by claiming that others in her position had done the same thing. That is a fatuous argument. It is a little like saying that other people have robbed banks, so it is okay for me to rob a bank. While it is true that some government officials had in the past used private email accounts for some occasional official business, the practice was rare. None of Clinton's predecessors created a private server for all their communications as Secretary of State. The reasons were quite simple. The law imposes strict rules limiting such use. First, the emails must be carefully preserved by the employee's agency. Second, the communications cannot be destroyed by the employee. Third, and most significantly, no classified material can be maintained on any private account. Clinton managed to violate these provisions of law during her 4-year tenure as Secretary of State. The public was unaware because there was no one in authority at the State Department to oversee whether Clinton was complying with the law. This would have been the duty of an internal inspector general who is charged with uncovering mismanagement and corruption. However, during the entire time of Clinton's service, President Barack Obama never nominated anyone to fill the position. While there was an acting inspector general, there was never a permanent IG who might have exercised greater authority to uncover how Clinton had circumvented the law. This was likely a deliberate arrangement furtively negotiated by Clinton. Any other explanation was implausible. Joseph DeGeneva, a former U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, who also served as an independent counsel, was blunt in his assessment of how Clinton avoided detection. She was surrounded by a group of people at senior levels who protected her and protected the information. And, of course, it wasn't on government servers, so there wasn't an easy way for people in government to find out about it. So she had a scheme, she had a methodology, and they had made sure that a watchdog was not present as long as she was Secretary of State. It was brilliantly carried out, and it was accomplished with the complicity of the President, who agreed not to appoint a permanent inspector general. The President and the people in the White House knew she had a private server, and they didn't object. Doug Burns, who served as Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, concluded that Clinton broke the law and should have been indicted for several crimes. The establishment of the private server and its use with classified information plainly violated the law, all of her excuses notwithstanding. And to those excuses, the withholding, wiping, and destruction of such huge amounts of email evidence removes all doubt about intent and knowledge. Given all the compelling evidence of criminality, how can it be explained that Hillary Clinton managed to escape prosecution? It appears she had considerable help. Chapter 2. Comey contorts the law to clear Clinton. It is a public scandal when the law is forced to uphold a dishonest act. Lord Edward Macnaghten, House of Lords, 1894. After a year of gathering incriminating evidence of wrongdoing, FBI Director James Comey held a news conference on July 5, 2016, to announce the findings of his investigation. Across the country, many of those closely following the case expected him to outline evidence of a series of crimes committed by Hillary Clinton for the Department of Justice to pursue. After all, many top officials who committed similar transgressions on a smaller scale saw criminal charges that ended their political careers. It was one of the most bizarre, bewildering, and incomprehensible explanations of a legal case in modern American history. Comey detailed evidence of crimes, but did not refer her for prosecution. Comey's assessment of the law was not just flawed, but completely inaccurate and conspicuously wrong. His reasoning for not recommending prosecution of Clinton was beyond improbable. It was impossible. Just as Lord Macnaghten feared, Comey bent and distorted the law to uphold dishonest acts by Clinton. Comey's tortured interpretation. In front of a national media, Comey read a lengthy statement that presented a compelling case of how Clinton repeatedly violated the law. 110 classified emails were stored by her on an unsecured private server in her home without authorization, and none of these emails should have been on any kind of unclassified system. Comey dismissed as untrue Clinton's ever-changing excuses that classified documents were marked in a way that she would not recognize them as such. But even if information is not marked classified in an email, participants who know or should know that the subject matter is classified are still obligated to protect it, he observed. For example, Comey cited 7 email chains involving top-secret communications, stating, "There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation." Clinton's routine failure to protect America's classified information jeopardized national security. We assess it as possible that hostile actors gained access to Secretary Clinton's personal email account, Comey concluded. Having laid out a meticulous case of how Clinton broke the law, Comey suddenly offered an implausible reason for why she should not be prosecuted. Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. The first part of Comey's finding, that there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes, was more than legally sufficient to refer the case to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution and presentment of evidence before a grand jury to seek an indictment. He unambiguously asserted facts which would meet any standard of probable cause that crimes appeared to have been committed by Clinton. On this basis alone, Comey was duty-bound to tender a criminal referral for prosecution. No subsequent qualifying predicate or condition to the statement can eliminate that legal requirement under the law. The second part of Comey's statement, that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case, was nothing more than speculation by him personally. The law does not accept this as a valid basis for declining to levy charges. Moreover, Comey had no grounds for making such a bold claim. He appeared to have simply invented it. In truth, plenty of prosecutors would have been willing to bring such a case, and indeed many have done so under similar circumstances. All the former FBI officials interviewed for this book said they have never heard of a decision being based on what a reasonable prosecutor might or might not do. Denny Colson, who served as Deputy Assistant Director of the FBI during his 3 decades at the Bureau and is also a lawyer, stated, "My view and the view of agents in the field was shock. When Comey came to the end and said no reasonable prosecutor in the entire country would prosecute Clinton, that was a total lie. I was flabbergasted. The agents were too. It didn't make any sense to any of us. There was never an FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton. Comey controlled it from start to finish and came out with the results he wanted." Former Assistant FBI Director Steve Pomerantz was equally shocked and appalled by what he witnessed the day Comey made his televised announcement. "I could have fallen off my chair while watching that news conference." Setting aside the conclusion he drew, it is not the FBI's job to recommend prosecutions. The FBI investigates and then turns it over to the Department of Justice. In all my years in the FBI, over 30 years, and hundreds of investigations, probably thousands, I never, ever saw that done. For Comey to do that was astonishing and wrong. Comey's assertion that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case was remarkably inaccurate. In truth, federal prosecutors have brought numerous cases against individuals who mishandled classified documents in much the same way that Clinton did. Samuel Sandy Berger, who served as National Security Advisor under President Bill Clinton, removed classified documents from the National Archives and stored them in an unauthorized location. Like Clinton, Berger said he did it for convenience. David Petraeus, who was director of the Central Intelligence Agency under President Barack Obama, kept classified documents at his home and allowed his biographer, with whom he was having an affair, to read them. Both Berger and Petraeus faced criminal charges and pled guilty. Both were fined, put on several years probation, and stripped of their security clearances. John Deutsch served as CIA director under President Clinton. Classified materials, including top-secret documents, were found on a computer in his home. While negotiating a plea agreement with prosecutors, he received a presidential pardon. Crucially, Petraeus, Berger, and Deutsch never worked for the government again. Even though none of them served time behind bars, their prosecutions and inability to maintain security clearances meant that the holding of high office was an impracticality. Had Clinton faced the same legal standard for mishandling classified documents, her ambition to serve as president would have ended. Other individuals who did not hold public office have also been prosecuted for the same actions as Clinton. Navy engineer Brian Nishimura downloaded classified documents on an unsecured computer system and stored them on personal electronic devices. He also destroyed some of the evidence. Like Clinton, he insisted that he had no intent to break the law. Nevertheless, he was charged and pleaded guilty in 2015. In 2016, a young Navy sailor, Petty Officer First Class Christian Saucier, was charged with mishandling classified material when he took 6 photographs of the inside of a submarine with his personal cell phone, an unauthorized and unsecured device. He was eventually forced to plead guilty, even though his attorney argued what he called the Clinton defense, claiming that if Clinton could get away with far worse conduct, his client should not be found guilty. The fact that the Clinton defense did not work for Saucier suggests that it would not have succeeded for Clinton. But of course, she was never even charged, unlike the sailor and several other troops. In March 2018, having served 1 year in prison, Saucier received a presidential pardon. Trump had previously noted that the sailor had been held to an unfair double standard compared to Clinton, who managed to escape prosecution entirely. During President Obama's term, more than half a dozen people were charged and convicted of mishandling classified materials. Nearly all of them served time behind bars. Thus, Comey's assertion that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case was demonstrably untrue. Proof of these prior cases of a similar nature made another of Comey's legal pronouncements even more bewildering. In his July 5th statement, he advanced this specious claim. "In looking back at our investigations into mishandling or removal of classified information, we cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts. All the cases prosecuted involved some combination of clearly intentional and willful mishandling of classified information, or vast quantities of materials exposed in such a way as to support an inference of intentional misconduct. The prosecutions of Berger, Petraeus, Deutsch, Nishimura, and Saucier disproved the first part of Comey's statement, since they all bear a notable resemblance to Clinton's case. Moreover, at the time Comey cleared Clinton, the FBI and the DOJ were already in the process of building a criminal prosecution against Harold T. Martin III, a former national security contractor who stored classified documents in his home, some of which were on his computers, just as Clinton did. Martin was arrested, charged, and jailed 1 month after Comey absolved Clinton for doing the same thing. The number of classified materials found at Martin's home was described by federal prosecutors as astonishing. The same could be said of Clinton's tranche of prohibited records.